Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
The first talk of this retreat rather sets the stage for the others, which is appropriate. The desire for happiness. Human tragedy to divine comedy. That definitely indicates two clear moments in salvation history. The first, human tragedy, original sin. Man abuses his freedom. The second, divine comedy. How an infinite, all-knowing, all-good God looked with mercy on his miserable creatures and sent his Son to accomplish their redemption. But there's a third moment mentioned there, which precedes these two. Implicitly referenced in the first words, desire for happiness. This phrase, I would note, recalls the initial creation of Adam and Eve, the original state where we discover the essence of human nature. What is it to be human? A nature which endures in spite of original sin and through redemption. So we could say that these are all three steps, really three steps of a divine comedy. Why? Because God in his divine providence knew from the very beginning that this peculiar human creature that he had made, though made for the highest good, would bring tragedy upon itself, but God, being all-powerful, would satisfy his divine justice and bring good out of evil. So we're going to address these three stages. So we begin, the desire for happiness. Now, a question might immediately arise. Are we really made for happiness? Are we really made for the good? Just check the daily media headlines, however you do that with whatever technology you do. And it seems to be a little bit otherwise. Why? Okay, I personally desire happiness. But there are so many people who seem to intentionally harm themselves and others. Can we really say that every human being is made for the good, is made for happiness? Now, to answer this question, I would like to propose consideration of two figures from the scriptures, one from the Old Testament and one from the New Testament. They'll kind of help us a little bit. The Old Testament is King Ahab. Now, who is King Ahab? Anybody remember? Yeah, who was he married to? Jezebel. You maybe remember Jezebel more than King Ahab, but anyway. King Ahab wanted his neighbor's vineyard. He wanted Naboth's vineyard. And he goes and asks Naboth for the vineyard, and Naboth says no. So Ahab is angry and depressed. He can't get what he wants. Now, both Ahab and his wife Jezebel presume that Ahab's happiness lies in what? In him getting this vineyard. So Jezebel comes up with a plan. Naboth will be falsely accused of blasphemy, and he will be put to death, and that will free up his vineyard. And Ahab will be able to get what he wants. He'll be happy, right? The plan works. Or does it? Something goes terribly wrong. Ahab is happy at that first moment, but his happiness is cut short because the prophet Elijah arrives, and he kind of pricks Ahab's conscience, and he condemns not only Ahab, but Ahab's sons. As a result, Ahab finds himself in another misery and despair and depression, and he again wants to escape it and find happiness. But this time, he takes a radically different approach without Jezebel. He tears his garments and sleeps in sackcloth. Now, we might be left questioning, how could one man seek happiness in such radically opposed actions? Murder
theft,
and then sackcloth and ashes. Was he really seeking this happiness, this goodness? You can ponder that. Let's move forward to the New Testament figure, the rich young man. Like Ahab and Jezebel, this young man was enterprising in his desire to attain happiness. He knew he wasn't happy. And so he does what? He approaches Christ and says, "Good master, what must I do?" Unlike Ahab, this young man has already begun walking the road towards God. When Christ tells him, "Keep the commandments," he can respond immediately, "I have kept all these from my youth." But here too, something goes awry in the encounter. When pushed to sell all he owns, the young man abandons Christ, returns to his great wealth. Note, there are no external forces. He freely chooses. Yet both Matthew and Mark say what? He went away sad. What's the problem? He freely chose great wealth, which in itself is not contrary to the commandments. We are told that Abraham was wealthy. The difference is that this young man was attached to his wealth, which is a lesser good, and it prevented him from choosing the greater good of following Christ. He sought his ultimate good and happiness in something finite. And like Ahab, he ended up sad and miserable. So, back to our question. Is every person, including Ahab, the rich young man, each one of us, are we all made for happiness? Now, throughout history, and even today, we get different answers to this. So just before we're assuming, yes, we are, but let's look at a little bit briefly at some of these other arguments. Some would say we aren't made for happiness. Sure, some people may be unhappy, but others are not. Like Ahab and the young man, they're going to go through life being miserable. That's their problem. But this answer contradicts our experience. Even if every person isn't happy, that doesn't mean that they don't seek some good, that they don't seek to be happy. Even if someone kills his neighbor, lies on the sofa all day, plays football, studies, works in a coal mine, robs banks, or gets high on drugs, are they seeking happiness? If you ask, what are they doing? Whether it's good or bad, as we look at it. Why do you rob banks? Well, I need money. We usually would go on with some other questions. Well, why do you want money? Well, I want to buy a house. Well, why do you want to buy a house? However many questions you have to answer, eventually you will probably get to the point where they will say, because it makes me happy. Or, because I don't want to be unhappy, which is the same question, or the same answer, right? Not being unhappy means you're happy, doesn't it, I think. Now, the philosopher and the theologian would explain this answer of, I'm ultimately seeking something that is going to make me happy, with a teleological argument. Now, some of you I know are studying philosophy and theology, and others of you are in the hard sciences. We were having that discussion earlier today. A teleological argument is just about ends, purposes. And so philosophers will say that everything seeks an end. It seeks its own good according to its nature, right? A perfect pen, even though it's inanimate, still has the nature of writing well, being used by a human being. And so a good pen writes well. A perfect pig? That's another question. I grew up on a farm. A good pig? Well, what does a pig want and what do I want of the pig? A good pig makes good bacon, right? Okay. And the perfect man? Well, what is his nature? His end must fulfill his nature, and our nature is rational. We seek the true, we seek the good, and we'll only really be happy when we arrive at the true good, the ultimate truth, contemplating this highest truth and union with this true good. Now, that's a big, broad, we'll be expanding upon that throughout the rest of this retreat. If this teleological argument is true, that everything is happy when it achieves its full end, its ultimate end of its nature, if we're made for happiness and we don't believe in an absurd universe, a necessary corollary will be, it must be possible for me to reach this happiness. Now, I did a very quick run through that, but that's what we're going to be talking about and something we do have to ponder. I am made for happiness, and I can achieve this happiness, and this happiness must fulfill my nature. But some people would say, I don't know. Okay, they're answering in a more nuanced manner. Okay, yeah, we're made for happiness. But each person determines what makes him or her happy. I want to be happy, but it's what I think will make me happy. This is a subjectivism, relativism, and as I say, I think Father Sherwin will address a little bit of this in further conferences. And also, going back to Ahab and the rich young man, they sought what they thought would make them happy, but were they happy? No. It's a little bit of a problem. We could also answer this question, something which I've already a little bit referred to in the response, but we are made for happiness. Our understanding would be, no, we are made for happiness. It's not defined by the individual. But as I say, it is a happiness that is ultimately fulfilling for every rational being. So as I say, I already used this even with the objection earlier that I gave. And if I'm unhappy, it doesn't mean I'm not made for happiness. And it doesn't mean that true happiness doesn't exist. Rather, it means I may fail to know or to acknowledge what will truly make me happy. Why? Often it's because I don't know who I really am and what it is to be human. And so I choose a finite good. And I think it's sufficient. But I never really achieve that happiness. No. That's part of the whole problem that we're kind of discussing here. Okay. And we're concluding that, yes, in a very simple way, we are all made for happiness. And it's going to fulfill our nature. But if we say that, there's another question that would arise. Where did this desire come from? If we are made for happiness and we have a desire, what's the source of that desire? Well, let me use here a different image. Many of you have seen, or at least you've seen in pictures, Michelangelo's painting of the creation of Adam and Eve in the Vatican Museum in the Sistine Chapel. John Paul II wrote the Roman Triptych, a commentary on this image. And he says that this fresco, and he's referring specifically to the central part where God is creating Adam and Eve, he says it's the key to the invisible beginning and end, the key to image and likeness. The invisible becomes visible. And I would add, it's also the key to understanding the origin of our desire for happiness. Michelangelo shows man, and man bears the image of the Creator. This man that Michelangelo is painting in some way reveals something of the Creator. So we look at this painting, and in seeing Adam and Eve, we see something of the Creator. Well, we also see God there, or do we? Could Michelangelo paint God? He shows God as Father and Creator, but he actually painted an image of man, didn't he? God has a head and he has arms and legs. He looks pretty much like a man. Something of a paradox here. The artist paints the invisible, omnipotent Creator, who is uncreated and incomprehensible. How can we define God by that image? As I say, he looks like man. And if I'm the image of that invisible God, how can I hope to understand myself? How can I come back and understand what my nature is and what is good for me? Well, we have a little bit of help beyond the fresco of Michelangelo. We've got the first chapters of Genesis. Now, we know that these chapters are a figurative story, right? They're not to be taken literally. But something is revealed when we read, "On the sixth day, God said, 'Let us make man in our own image, in the likeness of ourselves.'" And in chapter 2, "Yahweh God shaped man from the soil of the ground and blew the breath of life into his nostrils." Now, every created thing, even the pigs and rocks and the beauty we have around us, bears some image and trace of this creator. That's why all creation is said to be good. But Revelation says that only after God had created Adam and Eve did he call his creation very good. And we read in Ecclesiastes, "God created man right, just, ordered." And Gaudium et Spes says the same thing. Man is distinct from all creation. He's the only creature on earth that God wanted for its own sake. What does that mean? Well, as we're looking at Genesis, it first distinguishes human beings from all other creatures. But there's also another distinction as to human nature. That passage I just read, God says, "Let us make man in our own image, and then in the likeness of ourselves." Now, the fathers of the church and scholastics have spent a lot of time discussing likeness, image. What does it mean? Why are there two terms there? Thomas Aquinas gives us a good little synthesis with two helpful distinctions on these two terms, image, likeness. First, he says, well, image implies likeness. So what's the image of something? Well, it's like the other thing, right? He says, if you say, well, what's the likeness? He says, well, every likeness is not an image. What does he mean? Take two eggs. He uses this example. He says, you have two eggs. They're alike, right? But we usually wouldn't say this egg is the image of this egg. But we would say there's something alike there. But think of another example, a father and a son. There we have likeness. The father is like the son. But we also would say the son is the image of the father. So there's something different about these two terms. Now, Thomas also says something else about this, though. He says, well, it is specifically man's intellect which distinguishes him from all other creatures. It's the intellect that makes every human being the image of God. Image, he says, therefore refers to our immortal, rational soul. As an intellectual being, I have dominion over my actions, and that is that I am created imago Dei. The soul specifies what is the essence of the human nature. So that by the very fact of being of the human species, I am created imago Dei, even the worst sinner. Take the Joker in Batman. Did I get that one right? Yeah, the Joker, you know, everybody. Yeah. So even the Joker as a human being would be created imago Dei. Right? Well, what about likeness? Likeness is a step beyond. Likeness implies grace, something of the indwelling of the Trinity. Well, the Joker didn't have that, I don't think, if I could say that. Image is rooted in the essence of human nature, every human nature. It's about a natural aptitude for understanding, loving God. As such, that image isn't even lost by sin. But the more that human nature is perfected, conforming itself to God, the happier it is, true happiness, then it's going to bear something more of the likeness of God. That distinction makes sense. So we're saying goodness, as the idea of the nature, being a rational being, imago Dei is in every creature, sinner or not. Likeness is not. Likeness is in those who have that grace and are perfecting themselves more and more to be like God. So back to the question of happiness. Ahab and the young man. Nothing finite will make us perfectly happy. Why? Because of our nature. We're made for something more. We're made for something immaterial, uncreated. We seek perfect goodness, even if we are not consciously aware of it. Ahab sought that. The Joker sought that. But often we err. Aristotle, Aquinas, and others seem to have been correct when they say that man's ultimate happiness, again, lies in what? In a good that will perfectly fulfill our rational nature. Our soul is eternal. It doesn't die with our body. Everything material will pass away, so it can't fulfill my nature that lives on eternally. So whatever fulfills me must also be eternal. And although there are good things in the world that can make me happy for a time, whether it's a vineyard or whether it's my wealth, I'm always going to be seeking more. Therefore, as Benedict XVI wrote, he said, in man there is an inextinguishable yearning for the infinite. And I think we saw that in Ahab. We saw that in the rich young man. And even in the Joker. None of the answers attempted are sufficient. Only God himself, this is continuing with Benedict, only God himself who became finite, took on a human nature, can lead us to the breadth of his infiniteness, responding to the question of our being. So, from Revelation, what can we say? I'm not God. I didn't create myself. I'm limited. I'm destined for death. Remember, man, that you are dust. No human being, though, is evil per se, because every human being is imago Dei. And as to that happiness, recall Augustine's words, you have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you. Now that's step one. Now the bit in the middle. Human tragedy. Oh, happy fault. The devil and his followers were cast out of heaven, and the serpent, the most subtle of wild creatures, tempted the woman. Where was Adam? She, in turn, shared this pleasurable apple with Adam. And their eyes were opened, but their hearts were closed to relationship with their Creator. Oh, happy fault. Was it? Was it really happy? We sing that every Holy Saturday in the Exalted. Oh, happy fault, oh, necessary sin of Adam, which won for us so great a Redeemer. Yeah, but after the fall, Adam and Eve were not only cast out of the Garden of Eden, but by denying their creatureliness, they and all of their descendants were subject to death and suffering. That's us, right? Death and suffering. Oh, happy fault. Original sin is connected with one of the greatest and most difficult questions human beings have ever asked, Christian and non-Christian alike. Where does evil come from? What is the source of evil? Even Augustine wrote, I sought whence evil comes and there was no solution. But we know it exists, don't we? We've all experienced it, haven't we? Here again, we go to the Bible, which gives us some significant teaching on this point. Chapter 3 of Genesis. the account of the fall. Still figurative language. We don't know that there was really a tree. We don't know there was really an apple. But the church authoritatively teaches what? That this text affirms a primal event. Something happened. At the very beginning of the history of man, something happened. There was a fall. What are the effects? Theologians, again, for the years, have gleaned several different principles from this story of the fall and its relation to original sin. Number one, the tree of knowledge, knowledge of good and evil. Symbolically, it is a symbol of some way, evokes insurmountable limits that we have to respect. Now, we're in the midst of AI. Are there insurmountable limits? That's a big question today, isn't it? Genesis says there are. Number two, what does this story tell us? The devil exists, but he's limited. His power is limited. Our power is limited, but so is that of the devil. No, it was a temptation. Man responded freely, rationally. Adam and Eve could have resisted, just as each one of us can resist. Number three, what about their temptation? What was that temptation? Well, traditionally, the teaching is that what Thomas will say, it couldn't have occurred at the level of our passions, our desires, our sense passions. The emotions. Why? Well, because in Adam and Eve, they were created just. They were created right. So their emotions were in order with their intellect. If they were in order, how could they have fallen? It couldn't have been something there because their passions were in order with the intellect. So Thomas says what? Man's first sin had to be committed where? At the level of reason and will, as a rational being. The will of Adam and Eve was diverted from the unchangeable good of God to a limited good. Man chose himself over God. And then he blamed the woman, and the woman blamed the serpent, and on and on and on. Another point that we know from this first section of Genesis, the effects were immediate. Adam and Eve and all of his offspring, all of his descendants, lost sanctifying grace, lost the preternatural gifts. Harmony was destroyed. Harmony of Adam and Eve with God. Harmony between creatures. Remember, in the next chapter, Cain kills Abel. Harmony with creation. Look at ecology today. We have all this discussion. Why? What happened? The impact of our sin also impacted all of creation because man was the custodian of creation. And it also destroyed the inner harmony in the human being. That order of my passions to my intellect. But they were still ordered to the proper good. I still desire good things. It's just that they get out of order. They're not always in accord with reason. As Thomas says, what is natural to man, desire still for good, even sensible good, was neither acquired nor forfeited by sin. We're still made imago Dei. We are still made imago Dei. Commenting on the fall, the Council of Trent, back with the Protestant Reformation, noted a great irony. In wanting to be like God, man lost his likeness to God. He lost holiness and justice in which he'd been created and drew upon himself wrath and indignation. Adam, the perfect philosopher, bears children who have trouble learning. Adam, who would never die, grows old, buried by his sons who fight among themselves because some of them work and earn fruit by the labor, and others prefer lounging in the sun. Step three, the divine comedy, redemption. As I say, we still cry out. In spite of this, we still cry out on Holy Saturday, oh, happy fault. And as St. Paul says, where sin abounded, grace did abound all the more. Why? Because no sooner had we sinned than God came to our aid. But he knew the seriousness of the sin, and he respected our nature, our freedom. So Thomas will say, God worked slowly to bring us back to himself. He applied the remedy according to our nature in various stages. What are those stages? Step one, the intellect, the old law, the law of Moses. Thomas says that the very nature of our original sin required that the first step, because it was a sin of pride and it was a rational sin, Thomas says the first step of healing had to come at the intellect. Why? Because it's the intellect that knows what is good, that presents the true good to the will. And if that was where the problem came, it had to start there. That's where the remedy had to start. I can't choose good tea if I don't know what good tea is. I thought I knew what tea was until I lived with some Irish sisters in Rome. I had to know it before I could really desire it. The intellect directs us to our end according to a law. And a law is a measure of good acts. Now, even after sin, man was still, remember, still imago Dei. He still had a rational nature. He still knew the first principle of natural law. Do good, avoid evil. He even knew the proper common principles of that law. Continuation of being, procreation, especially for human beings speaking there, education of offspring, the social life, the communal nature of our human being, and knowledge of God. But that sin had obscured our intellect, and so oftentimes he erred. So Thomas says, what did God do? Because of that intellectual weakness, darkening, God revealed his law to Moses. God restored something of a sense of sin and virtue by giving us the written law. The law contained the natural principles, the principles of natural law, but also some divine commands, like worshiping God on Sunday. Natural law told us to know God and to worship God, but the divine command said, this is how you will worship God. So it compensated for the weaknesses, the inadequacies that were caused by sin, and provided something of a certitude. We can speak of this law of Moses, the Torah, something of grace by anticipation. Why? Well, we didn't have grace formally yet until Christ comes. The law didn't give grace, but instilled a fear of the Lord based on Christ who would come. There's another beautiful story in the Old Testament that illustrates this anticipation of grace in the law. It's the story of King Josiah. Josiah became a king when he was about 8 years old. His father was Amon, who got murdered pretty early on. Why? Well, because he wasn't the best guy. And his grandfather was Manasseh. He wasn't that great either. His great-grandfather was a little better, Hezekiah. Manasseh and Amon, Josiah's father and grandfather, both promoted idolatry, not worshiping the true God, and they suppressed the study of the law, the Torah. Well, when King Josiah was ruling, a priest found a copy of the Torah. It was taken to King Josiah, and King Josiah said, read this to me. And when his secretary read the Torah, Josiah tore his garments. Why? Because he realized this is the word of God. He confirmed the words of Sirach, the beginning of wisdom is fear of the Lord. And Josiah had that fear of the Lord. That's step one. Step two of the remedy. The will. As good as the law was, it couldn't make us follow it. It was an exterior standard. It didn't rectify my will. It told me what was good, but it didn't give me the ability to follow it. It didn't give me the strength. A second remedy was needed. Grace. to remove the malice of the will that came from original sin so I could choose that good. These two remedies, law, grace, they're not opposed. Both reveal something of God's divine providence. Now, here I want to refer to another father of the church, St. Athanasius. You may have read his On the Incarnation. Wrote long ago about this remedy, the climax of the divine comedy. And he wrote about it as a resolution to a great problem that God faced. Now, God really has no problems, but still, Athanasius presents this problem. God created man for himself, for this good. He warned him and said, there's a tree, don't eat it. Man ate it. He ignored the warning and ate it. Lost God's favor, and he cut himself off from God's grace. This is what Athanasius calls, what develops out of this is the divine dilemma. What's a dilemma? You have a couple of possible solutions, but neither one of them is good. God. What's this dilemma? God, supremely good, just creator, had every right to destroy Adam and Eve and their offspring. They disobeyed him. Or he could have just let them destroy themselves. He didn't even have to destroy them. Why? Because the sin was so corruptive. Man wasn't strong enough to resist. He would have just ended up destroying himself. God could have just sat back and watched man destroy himself. The only hope for surviving this original sin was some exterior power had to come in. Okay, so God could have just destroyed. But on the other hand, it was unworthy for God. He was so good that creatures made by him would be brought to nothing. It was supremely unfitting, Athanasius says, that the work of God in mankind should disappear, either through his own negligence or because of the deceit of the devil. So what did God do? This was his dilemma. So this supremely good, just God did what no one could have imagined. He sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to deliver those who are subject to the law. Athanasius notes that God's resolution to the dilemma is so perfect, it resolves all issues and transcends all expectations. Even those who want to go back to the pagans and their gods, they couldn't come up with a God like our God. They came up with all kinds of solutions, but they couldn't arrive at the solution that God gave. Therefore, Athanasius says what? God sent his son, a son of God who could not die, to take upon himself a body capable of death. So that participating in the Word, who is above all, through that indwelling Word, who would remain incorruptible, corruption might cease. Interesting point here. Matthew Levering also highlights this in his writings, also commenting on Athanasius. Athanasius makes a very, he emphasizes it's the Son who is the Word. Well, the Word, the Son, is the image of the Father, right? He's a perfect image. But we're also the image of that image in our rational nature, which is very apropos, right? Because it's our rationality whereby we can speak, which is the image of the Word, who is the image of the Father. The perfect image, and we're the imperfect image of that image in our rationality. So I bring this to a conclusion. We've got those three steps very briefly. I'm going to conclude with Catherine of Siena. She's my last talk, but I'm going to talk about her a little bit here. Why? She kind of summarizes this divine comedy from a different perspective, from the perspective of mercy. In two brief paragraphs, she's praying to the Father. And she goes through creation, sin, redemption. She says to the Father, your mercy created us. The same mercy redeemed us from eternal death. Your mercy rules over us and holds back your justice, keeping the earth from swallowing us up, keeping animals from devouring us. We're here in the wilds of Ireland. Just kidding. In fact, all things serve us and the earth gives us its fruit. All of this because of your mercy. Your mercy preserves us. It prolongs our life. It gives us time to return and to be reconciled by you. O eternal mercy, you cover the defects of your creatures. We all have defects. God's mercy, Catherine says, just covers them. God doesn't even look at them. O ineffable mercy, in mercy we were created. Through your mercy we were recreated. Your mercy preserves us. Your mercy gives us life. This God is so good, Catherine says. He even seems to act like he needs us. Do you need your creature? How can God need us? She says, it seems so. Why? You act as if you can't live without me. How crazy. She even calls God crazy. She says, he's madly in love with us. He's crazy in love with us. Even he's drunk in love with us. It seems you run. You can't live without her. Why? She runs away from you. You go looking for her. Why are you so mad? She asks God, why are you so mad? Because you have fallen in love with what you made. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.